Chapter 53. Motiveless Murder. A yellow Chevrolet cruises slowly down the street in a quiet Los Angeles suburb. As it passes a lawn on which a four-year-old girl is playing, it slows down. A man leans out of the rear window and blasts her with a shotgun. A few moments later, the child, Joyce Ann Huff, dies in the arms of her sobbing mother. Later, three men are charged with the murder, and the one who fired the shot has a long police record, but no motive. Police describe it as a thrill killing, like deer stalking or shooting partridge. In the wilds of Montana, a man dressed as a cowboy rides his horse along a quiet country road. A stranger stops his car to ask him the way. The cowboy pulls out his six-shooter and shoots him through the head, and then he rides on. He's living out his fantasy of being part of the old Wild West. A bachelor named Norman Smith sits watching TV in a caravan in Florida. The programme is called The Sniper. It's about a man with a psychopathic hatred of women. When it's over, Smith takes his revolver, walks along the road until he finds a lighted window and a woman watching her television, and shoots her. Smith did not know the woman he killed, Mrs. Hazel Woodard, and neither did she know him. In Cuba, New Mexico, a jeep stops near a woman who stands talking to a neighbour, while two children play nearby. The bearded driver raises his rifle and shoots the children. Then he drives away, leaving one child dead, the other dying. Trapped by a posse a few hours later, he explains that he had a sudden impulse to do something about the population explosion. They ask if he knew that the mother of one of the dead children had 10 other children. He shrugs and admits that he'd never seen any of them before. In recent years, motiveless murder has become the most typical and perhaps the most frightening crime of our time. This is particularly true of the United States, where it's reached epidemic proportions. Psychologists and criminologists seem baffled by the nature of such crimes. How can one analyse the motive of a motiveless murder? It's easy to talk about a generalised resentment against society, but that explains hardly anything. The anarchists of the 1890s had plenty of resentment about society, but they murdered kings and presidents. What can one say of a man who murders perfectly ordinary, innocent people? That he's insane? Well, this explanation fits only a tiny percentage of motiveless killers. The rest are quite definitely sane in the legal sense. This is an area in which, in the 1960s, a new theory was developed by A.E. Van Vogt, which provides some vital clues. Van Vogt is best known as an American writer of science fiction. He's also a brilliant and unorthodox psychologist. There are many psychologists now who believe that his theory about violent men could be one of the most important breakthroughs since Sigmund Freud discovered the unconscious. Studying newspaper reports of divorce cases, Van Vogt noticed an interesting pattern. Many husbands seemed inclined to make unreasonable and almost incredible demands on their wives and to treat them like slaves. A basic characteristic of such husbands was that they would never admit that they were ever in the wrong. If the facts were obviously against them, such men would fly into a rage, punch or beat the wife, and sometimes the children, and end by establishing to their own satisfaction that they were right all the time. Van Vogt called such a man the right man. He cites a typical case of a right man. When a nurse was about to get married, she thought it only fair to tell her husband that she was not a virgin. In fact, she had had two affairs with doctors. The husband-to-be flew into an almost insane frenzy of jealousy, and she thought that was the end of their relationship. But the next day he brought her a document to sign. He wouldn't allow her to read it. He just insisted that, if they were still to get married, she had to sign it. And so she did. During their marriage, she was treated as an object. Her husband's job involved much travelling, and she soon came to suspect that he was having affairs with other women. If she ever complained that he had stayed away for weeks at a time, he flew into a rage. On the other hand, he was intensely suspicious of his wife, and likely to lose his temper and knock her down at the least provocation. He would usually be apologetic the next day, but that wouldn't stop him from repeating his violent pattern a couple of days later. Any triviality was enough to set off storms of shouting. Finally, the wife could no longer stand it and insisted upon a divorce. The husband agreed to this and then set her up in a suburban home on condition that she did not remarry and would devote her life to being an ideal mother to their young son. Van Vogt believes that the paper she signed declared that she admitted to being little more than a whore and had absolutely no rights as a married woman. If necessary, the husband might produce this paper in court. It sounds as if such a man must be close to the verge of insanity, or at least a nervous breakdown, but this proved to be untrue. Many similar husbands were successful businessmen, held in high esteem by their associates and regarded as decent sorts. It was only their wives and families who brought out the element of the tyrant in them. Van Vogt made an extremely interesting observation about right men. They often desert their wives, but if by some odd chance the wife deserts them, the result is a severe mental shock. They may go grovelling, begging her to return. If she refuses, they can experience a severe depression that could end in death. Each of the husbands has built a fantasy world on the idea of himself as a kind of monarch, an absolute ruler within his own household. If this fantasy collapses, it's like removing his linchpin. He disintegrates. But why should that be so? At this point, it becomes clear that the violent man, an alternative name for the right man, has built an entire structure of self-esteem on his domination of his wife. In that one respect, he feels like a little god. Most people build their self-esteem on certain achievements or relationships or even objects, the family car, the greenhouse, the colour TV. The 19th century Russian writer Nikolai Gogol has a story called The Overcoat, in which a humble, rather depressed little clerk gains self-esteem from a new overcoat, and then goes insane when it's stolen. Most people have a number of foundations for their self-esteem, so that if one collapses, the damage is not too difficult to repair. The right man is tempted to build everything on one single plank. If it collapses, he feels he is nobody. Van Vogt made the interesting comment that he was convinced that many famous dictators have been, or are, right men, including Hitler, Stalin, and Mao Zedong. Hitler's sexual relations certainly seem to confirm this. He chose girls like Geli Raubel and Eva Braun, who were quiet, domesticated types whose chief function was to adore him. When Geli Raubel committed suicide to escape his domination, Hitler himself came close to suicide. When the right man gains a position of power, it's a poor lookout for his country. Totally incapable of self-discipline, completely spoilt like an overindulged child, he always blames his own shortcomings on others. At the least suspicion of opposition, he flies into a paranoid rage and the heads roll. It's such displays of emotion which forge the connection between the right man and motiveless murder. To begin with, it stresses that men who have become the victims of their own power mania often order executions on the most inadequate grounds. And they need not even be in a rage. In 1861, for example, the English explorer John Hanning Speke was in Africa, hunting for the source of the Nile. In February of the following year, he was the guest of the young King Mutesa of Uganda. He presented the king with various guns. The king asked for a demonstration of their power and sent for 4 cows, which Speke shot. The king was delighted. He handed a carbine to an urchin who was standing nearby. "See if it will kill a man," he ordered. The boy ran into an outer courtyard. There was a crash, and he came running back, grinning delightedly. "Did it work?" asked the monarch. "Oh, yes," came the reply. He had been supplied with weapons which did not belittle his status, and he demanded no more and no less. In primitive societies, the king was often an absolute ruler who commanded the power of life and death. He regarded this as his absolute right. Ivan the Terrible, Tsar of Russia in the 16th century, would have courtiers tortured and executed for some minor breach of etiquette, which he felt reflected on his dignity. When the free city of Novgorod refused to recognise his sovereignty, he spent 5 weeks torturing to death its inhabitants at the rate of thousands a day. He often had children tortured in front of their mothers, and then the mothers were roasted alive. When most of the inhabitants of Wenden in Livonia blew themselves up in a castle rather than fall into his hands, he rounded up every remaining inhabitant of the town and tortured them to death. Ivan was a supreme example of a violent man. But he was not insane, and nor were the many other tyrants of history. There is a touch of the right man in everybody. Everybody gets angry with people who oppose and frustrate them. Everybody would like to see such people forced to apologise abjectly. In our fantasies, we're all tyrants sometimes. And from the point of view of human evolution, it's a good thing we are. The will to power is as important to evolution as the sexual urge. A man with a strong will to power is likely to make a good father and provider. And although tyrants like Ivan the Terrible and Stalin may have been bad for their victims, they were very good for the country as a whole, binding it into unity. Even the sexual urge is built on the will to power. The male desire to enter strange female bodies is a dominance urge. And when a man and a woman are ideally suited to one another, it is because, in the sexual act, the man enjoys playing his dominant role and the woman enjoys playing her submissive role. The key word here is playing. Sensible people are flexible and adjustable. They don't take the power game too seriously. They don't want to achieve self-esteem at too cheap a price. They're realistic enough to prefer real achievement to the feeling of power that comes from bullying and exercising petty or domestic authority. In a hierarchy of values, the need for self-esteem comes above the need for sex and love. When a man has got a secure sexual background, he starts to want the respect and admiration of society, to feel himself to be a somebody. At the present moment, Western society has evolved to the self-esteem level. This means that more murderers than ever before are motivated by the need for self-esteem. At the same time, there is more general prosperity now than at any time in history. A few centuries ago, it was only the rich and the powerful who had the time or the freedom to indulge their will to power. Nowadays, there are millions of people in Europe and in America who are, relatively speaking, as well off as the Ugandan King Mutesa, living in comfortable homes with money enough to buy a great deal of consideration from society. In these circumstances, the spoiltness that is the chief characteristic of the right man has plenty of room to develop. At first sight, there may not seem to be much in common between King Mutesa and the Chicago thrill killers Leopold and Loeb. But psychologically speaking, there is a very close resemblance. The right man is wrapped up in himself. In an odd way, he doesn't really believe that other people are real, so he feels no conscience about treating them as mere objects. Norman Smith, living alone in his caravan in Florida, was almost certainly a right man. But living alone, he had no one on whom to impose his will to power. Watching the television programme on the sniper suddenly showed him the way to express it. He could take his revolver, shoot somebody through a window, preferably a woman so that sexual dominance was also involved, and then, as he came home afterwards, he would feel that he was somebody. The same pattern can be seen in all the major cases of motiveless murder. Ian Brady, the British Moors murderer, told his henchman David Smith that he had committed at least one motiveless killing, that he had stopped his car in a dark street, got out, shot a stranger who was walking along the pavement, and then driven off. This was probably fantasy. The police have no record of such a shooting, but it shows the pattern of Brady's thinking. Ed Sanders' book on the Charles Manson crimes, The Family, makes it clear that Manson developed all the characteristics of a right man in the 2 years before his arrest. The need for absolute, total authority over his followers, the wild rages if anyone expressed doubt, the blinding manic resentment against anyone who had humiliated him. At the time the Manson family had embarked on its career of slaughter in Los Angeles, another killer in San Francisco was engaged in a series of motiveless murders. The man, who's called the Zodiac Killer, has never been caught. In December 1968, two teenagers sitting in a station wagon were shot dead. In July 1969, a man pulled up alongside another couple on a Columbia Parkway. He got out of his car, shot them both, and then phoned the police, telling them that he had also murdered those kids last year. The shot man, Michael McGean, survived and confirmed that the killer had shot at him and his girlfriend and then walked away. It was after this that San Francisco newspapers began receiving letters signed with the astrological signs of the zodiac, and boasting that the writer would commit more murders. In September 1969, the killer tied up a couple and then stabbed them both repeatedly. Again, the man survived. 2 weeks later, the man called Zodiac shot a taxi driver in the back of the head and strode off. Again, there was no motive. On October the 19th, 1970, not long after the Manson trial had started, the home of a wealthy California eye surgeon was seen to be on fire. In the swimming pool, firemen discovered 5 corpses. That of the eye surgeon, Victor Ochter, his wife, their 2 children, and his secretary. A note found in the doctor's car declared that World War III had begun. It was signed with names taken from tarot cards. The murderer's fingerprints on the car and on a beer can led the police to John Lindley Frazier, 24 years old, a car mechanic and hippie separated from his wife. The evidence showed that Frazier had planned the murders some days in advance and had found Mrs. Ochter alone and executed her by shooting her in the back of the head. Later, when the secretary, the children and the doctor returned, he executed them in the same manner. England's first case of motiveless murder came to light in November of 1971, when the police arrested 24-year-old Graham Young and charged him with the poison murders of 2 workmates and the attempted murder of 2 more. It was only after he had been sentenced to life imprisonment that newspapers were able to reveal that, at the age of 14, Young had been charged with poisoning several members of his own family, one of whom, his stepmother, had died. The schoolboy chemist was an admirer of the great poisoners. He was sent to Broadmoor, the institution for the criminally insane. In the book Obsessive Poisoner by Young's sister, the usual typical motiveless murder pattern emerges. He had a craving to be known, to be famous. He regarded himself as highly intelligent, and he felt that he had no proper outlet in his working-class background. The admirer of Hitler, the man who referred to himself as your friendly neighbourhood Frankenstein, began to toy with the idea of committing murder with an almost unknown poison, thallium. Observers at his trial noted an odd thing. He seemed to be basking in the limelight, almost as if it were worth a lifetime in jail to be recognised as one of the company of the great poisoners. Van Vogt's right man theory could be a turning point in criminological science. It provides a new way to the psychology of men like Manson, Frazier, and Graham Young. Whether it can help to prevent motiveless murders is another matter, but to understand why they happen will be a major step towards it.